Okay, I'm here with George Royce for our second taping, and we left off on the last tape discussing the death of your father, and what that meant for you was that you would be stepping into farming, which you had not planned on doing before. So I'd like you to fill me in on the details of how that exchange took place, with him stepping back and you stepping forward into the business.
Well, with Dad in the hospital, the entire operation had to keep going, and my mother and I decided that I would run the operation that summer at least, and so off to the field I went with a crew of men ready to run the combines, and Dad also had a seed cleaning operation that he had built up for several years, cleaned mostly for himself, but also for some outside people. And that was an operation I knew absolutely nothing about, but we had a cleaner man that was pretty good there, and so we felt comfortable with that. We had a manager in an office in Imler that took care of the buying and selling, and then we also sold chemicals and fertilizer a little bit. But the first concern was getting out and getting the machines going in the grass fields, and the operation had changed a little while I'd been gone, and we were just incorporating combines into the grass operation. When I had left and gone into the service, they still used the thrashing machine, which was a machine that you took the bundles out of the field and pitched bundles into the thrashing machine. It was the same operation that had been used in wheat. And you had to have a binder, of course, that put the grass into the bundle and wrapped a string around it and everything. But those had the year before I came home from the service, they had started in with combines, and so this was all new. Hadn't done a bit of it before, and I had excellent help to help me through that first summer. Dad had had such a bad heart attack that they didn't allow him to even go to the field, couldn't even drive out and take a look for the first 30 days. And then after he did start going out, he decided that it was time to let me take over on the operation if I so desired. And so that from that time on, I pretty much ran the farm. I don't know if I told you the other day about the man that drank alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he quit the first week. That was the cleaner man.
Okay.
And so we had a big replacement to do there. We had to find somebody that could clean the seed in the warehouse. And at the end of the first month, the manager of the warehouse and the office and everything, he presented an ultimatum to us of what he thought he deserved to have if he was going to have more responsibility. And so the first thing we know, he's down the road too and gone. Well, Dad came and started concentrating all his effort on the seed cleaning, and then he started to put up a bulk fertilizer plant, because the grass seed takes lots of fertilizer, and we had all these sacks that you had to open 100 pounds at a time, and that was just more work than we wanted to do if we were going to expand the grass seed, which is what we planned on doing, raising more grass seed. So Dad concentrated on everything in Imler, building a new bulk warehouse, so we had bulk seed by the second year I was on the farm instead of sacks. The first year when I took over, it was all sacked, all of the field run grass that was coming in out of the field and going to the warehouse. But by the second year, we'd started into bulk grass seed. So there were a lot of changes in the industry in the valley right at that time, as Dad and I made this change on the ranch also, and I took over. Mm-hmm. He stayed out of my way quite a bit in the beginning, and well, all the way through from then on. He pretty much let me run the farm, and it was totally different than when you just are out there and somebody's telling you what to do. Dad had had that good foreman. He stayed with me about 2 or 3 years. And about the second year out, when I was farming, my wife's father, who was working at the mill in LeGrand and had always wanted to farm, he came out and he and I worked out an arrangement with Dad. And my father-in-law, Doyle Eismayer, put all of his ground in with our ground, because he had some acreage that he owned, and he and I ran the farm together. And that lasted for about 4 years, the two of us together, and then he branched off onto his own after about 4 years. But he was an excellent farmer, just an outstanding farmer. And so between my dad watching what I was doing, the foreman for the first 2 or 3 years, and then my wife's father coming in and working with me, I had some of the best guidance that a person could ever want, even though I hadn't planned on farming and had never really, you know, prepared myself, I guess, mm-hmm. for that.
Tell me about the process of grass seed. What does that involve?
Well, when you plant an acre of grass, you plant it in rows, and the reason it's planted in rows is so that then you can manage the off types and the weeds and any contaminants that might be in it in the early years of the stand. We plant in the spring here because we've tried fall planting and we just can't get a good stand, so we plant it in the spring.
What do you mean by stand?
Whenever, as it grows and comes up, okay. A stand would be the emergence of the plant in the row, and so we plant in the spring. We weed it, spray it, fertilize it, baby it along the first year, and then the second year of the establishment, we get a crop. And then we get about 5 years out of it total, so that would be about 4 years that we get a crop without reseeding. It'd be just like your lawn or something like that. I mean, you know, it's there and it's established, and each year it reemerges and comes up and produces seed.
Okay. So when you harvest the grass, do you say harvest the grass or grass seed?
Well, you harvest the grass for seed.
Okay. So how does that work?
Basically, as the changes came, we went away from the old way of doing it. It works about like you would work with hay. You put it in a swath row, mm-hmm. and of course, but then you don't bale it. You have a combine with a special attachment on the front, a belt pickup that comes along in about a week or 10 days, depending on the variety of grass, and picks the swath row up when it's dry, and it goes into the combine and through the combine just like wheat or any other crop, and you separate the seed from the straw into the bulk tank and out of the bulk tank and into a truck. And the truck goes off to the warehouse and dumps the seed and the chaff and the weed seed and everything that you've got collected.
Okay.
And dumps it at the warehouse.
Now, how many types of seed are you talking about? How many varieties did you get?
All the varieties have changed over the years. Our biggest crop was bluegrass and fescue, and there were two types of fescue, a creeping red fescue and a chewing fescue, and then a lot of different named varieties.
Can you spell fescue for me?
F-E-S-C-U-E.
Okay.
And when we first were starting, when I came back, there were not a lot of varieties, a half a dozen. Now you'd have to go get the book out in the dictionary. I mean, they have literally hundreds of varieties now. The plant breeders all breed up their own variety and put a name on it and try to tell everybody it's better than something else, which some of them are. But when I started, there weren't that, you know, there weren't a whole lot of varieties. Marion Bluegrass was one of the big bluegrasses that started that got a big name. Mm-hmm. So
once the seed is harvested, then you tell me about how it's put into the tanks and then into the trucks and then shipped and sorted and all of that kind of stuff. Did it sell locally?
No. Most everything would sell on the international market. We would just raise the seed for, well, let me back up. When we first started, it was all on the open market. When I first started, it was all open market seed. You would have a variety, and you would raise it, clean it, have it cleaned at the warehouse, and then you would put it on the open market and see if somebody would buy it. But later, in the late 70s, companies started coming in with a variety, and they would ask you if you would raise their variety, their name, and their seed, and then they would guarantee you a price before you ever planted it or put it in the ground. I mean, it was a totally different concept. And at first, we resisted that because we thought, oh, we'd like to be independent and we'll just do our own thing. But the companies that were doing this, a lot of them had really good varieties of bluegrass and fescue, and so if you were going to get the better yield and you know, just they paid good money, a lot of them, to do that, especially if you were a good farmer and going to raise really good stuff for them. Mm-hmm. So we eventually ended up to where probably 70 or 80% of our production was already contracted before we ever planted it.
Tell me about the different seasons and how your day would change depending on that season.
Okay, well, the spring, we always figured we had to be ready to go by March 15th. That was pretty much kind of a deadline as to, that would be about the time we would normally get into the field and you would start your planting. You, of course, you had all your ground preparation, your plowing and your spring toothing and harrowing and then planting, and get the crop started growing. And then...
Can you back up a little bit and explain
okay.
A spring tooth?
Oh, it's just a tool that bounces over the top of the ground and drags a little dirt around to pack it and level. You really need things level and packed. It'd be the same as if you were working out in your flower garden and had it all shoveled up, you know, and it'd be kind of lumpy and not pretty and not smooth. And a spring tooth and a harrow were both tools that would go across the ground and move ground like a garden rake, only in a little different mode, and that would smooth it out. You need it smooth because later on in your process, when you're harvesting, you want everything as smooth and level and even, so that if the crop were to have a storm come through and lay down, you could go along with your swathers and pick it all up. So level was important, and that's part of what we were doing there. Then once you got things going with your new crop, you had your old crop, maybe, you know, the one from the year before that. And you started with your spray programs to take care of weeds and insects. And you started with a fertilizer program on some crops. And then you had on the ground that was irrigated, you had to get your irrigation going as soon as things started to dry out too much. So that was what the spring amounted to.
So was this set up in a rotating basis where for 1 year you may have some things that are in a different process than where they are on another field?
Very definitely, because that's how you protect yourself. You don't want to, I guess the old saying, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, because, you know, you drop the basket, you're in tough shape, and that would be what would happen if you had everything in the same crop. You could get yourself in trouble. And timing-wise, too, you know, I mean, if all your ground was in the same thing, then next Tuesday morning, everything would be ready to go at the same time.
Right.
But if you got different crops in different stages and a different ground maybe in a little different part of the valley, you know, because one part of the valley would be ready to go and another one might not.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the diversification was a must if you were gonna do it.
Okay. So then from the spring, after you did the planting, then what does the next season bring?
Well, normally along about June, you're starting to finish up with the watering, with the irrigation. The first or the second week in June, all that's tapering off. There used to be a little bit of a break right in there when we just had the grass and the wheat and the peas. There would be a little bit of break right there in the first part of June. We wouldn't be very busy. Still have something to do, but not really busy. Then towards the end of June and the first of July, as we'd start preparing for the grass harvest. And when we were raising peas, the peas would really take a lot of water right through that time too, so that was going on. But we were normally not quite into the field by the 4th of July. It was always a big iffy. Were we going to get the 4th of July off, or were we going to work on the 4th of July? And normally we got it off. And then right after that, the grass harvest started, and the swathers would go to the field, and we'd start swathing the grass. And then before we'd finish swathing the grass, some of it would be ready to combine, and the combines would start up. And at that point in time, you're just about as busy as you can possibly get, because basically we'd be running two crews. And the swathers would be running night and day sometimes, and then you were trying to get a crew together to run the combines.
How many combines were going at one time?
Oh, it just depended on how many you had. Anywhere from 3 to 6 or 7, probably depends on. I mean, it varied over the years.
Mm-hmm.
We ran 4 combines for a long, long time, and then eventually went up to 5, and. Then we had 6 or 7, as some of the newer combines got bigger, and the old combines, we kept them going probably longer than a lot of people, but they're all out now, and we run 5 combines now. Mm-hmm. My son does.
Can you tell me about the irrigation system?
Irrigation, our irrigation was mostly from the creek in the early years. Dad started the irrigation system in the late 40s, and it was really simple and small, and he had a field of grass that was dying. It was a brand new field that was dying, and he thought if he could just get some water on it, he could save it. It was because it was a real dry spring. So that's what started the irrigation for us, and I suppose he probably had one, if not the first irrigation system in the valley, he had one of the first.
Did you ever have any issues over water rights?
Oh, minor ones. People always have water right issues, and over the years, sure, there have been times that there have been, you know, arguments, and most of the time you just go to the watermaster and he straightens it out and says who can do what. We didn't have a lot of issues because with Dad being one of the very early irrigators, our water rights were some of the first. So there might be issues, but we didn't have problems because we were some of the first to irrigate, and they held up.
Now, was there any policy or any specific thing that you had to do to maintain your water rights, or was it a matter of first come, first serve, so you don't lose what you already have?
You have to put water on the ground once every 5 years to maintain a water right. You have to cover the ground and show that you are still using that water right once every 5 years, and that's about it. Which, when you're in a farming operation, that isn't a big problem because, you know, you're going over the ground two or three times anyway. So, yeah, that's never been a problem with us.
Okay. So, along towards the end of the summer, you're heading into the harvest time. Can you tell me about a typical day during harvest?
Well, I don't know that you could find a typical day in harvest. Like I say, when you were running both crews, you were out night and day quite a bit, and you just try to catch what sleep you could. And each year would vary and differ. When some of my easiest years were when the kids were growing up, because they were excellent operators of the swathers and machinery, and that took a big load off of me. I mean, if your own family's out there doing it, you know they're going to be doing the best job they can. If you have somebody out there that just doesn't care, then you have to be there more. I mean, you have to be out there where you can see what their procedures are and what they're doing, and that makes a lot of difference. So it's really difficult to say what a typical harvest day was because there was a lot of variety in the number of hours you put in. I would guess that most of the time in harvest, you're probably there 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, right through that really about a month, at least a month, month and a half. And the reason I can say that is because I know some of the men that turned in time, you know, hours on their time, they were working just as long and hard as I was, and there were a lot of 14-hour days. 12 would be a pretty much of an average, I think.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned earlier in our taping about your mother coming out to the fields when you were growing up, and
I don't know where you're going, but we'll find out.
I was asking about, you had told me before about your mother who would go out to the crews and take them hot food. So now as things have progressed and several years later and you have all of these crews working day and night, did your wife do the same thing?
Well, no. It seemed like we went to sandwiches. The crews had changed a little bit. The type of people that we hired. When Mom was taking the hot food and things out, there were older men that would probably follow the harvests, and they'd be hobos or they'd be people that just traveled everywhere just looking for summer work and things like that. By the time I took over, we had a little bit of that, but not nearly as much, and so most of the people were local or kids. We started hiring a lot of young high school and college kids that came out and worked, and they just brought sandwiches with them and furnished their own lunch. And so that was a change also. There were so many things that changed right at the time I took over that it's hard to remember them all. It really is. So.
You had also mentioned that you hired a lot of young people, and before that you mentioned that you hired your kids, or you said they worked. You didn't say you hired them.
I didn't hire them. No, they were not on the payroll.
When did they start being old enough, growing up like that? What is the appropriate age to get out there on the combine?
Well, I think the age is just whenever they felt they could do it. By the time they were 12 or 13, they were they were undoubtedly doing some things, but they started on swathing the grass by the time they were 12, 13, 14 years old, and they were really good. And I'd just take them out. They'd ridden with me as they were, when they were young, you know, they'd come out as most 7, 8, 9-year-olds will do and ride around with Dad for a little while. And so when I thought they were ready to go, I just would pick out a field that was in good condition, and the grass was all standing up, and I'd go around with them, and then I'd just turn the controls over to them and make a round or two, and then I'd step off the swather and say, "You take it around the field," because if you're sitting there watching them, they're too nervous to do anything, and there wasn't much they could mess up on, really. So away they'd go, and they all became really good at operating machinery. Okay. The girls were better than you'd ever imagine. I'll tell you a story right here. We had a local girl, about 6 foot tall, that was running a combine one year for us, a really nice gal. And we had some visitors from Turkey coming in, a man and his wife, and they came in with a neighbor, and they looked at our operation and everything. And I asked them if they would like to ride on one of the combines, and they were thrilled to do that. Well, you should have seen the look on the woman's face when the combine pulled up and a girl stepped out of the combine, and that was the combine that was going to let the woman ride around the field on, because in Turkey, that was, I mean, it would never happen, a woman working and driving a big piece of machinery like that. And I've never forgotten the expression on her face when she saw that young girl crawl out of that combine.
Did you find that that there were a lot of young women in this area who were doing that sort of work?
Oh, I think so. And yeah, the starting in the 1980s, girls started doing way more work in the field, and they'd always hoed grass with a hoe to hoe out the weeds and things like that, and they'd done a lot of work, but they took over and started on the machinery. And I always felt that probably girls were better than boys because they were more conscientious, they were a little more scared, and I don't think, at least in the 1980s and early 90s, that the girls had the idea in their head that they wanted to be a hot rod drag racing queen or something, which the boys all had that. Whenever the time they got around a piece of machinery, they had these big thoughts in their head about, oh boy, here I am, you know. But the girls were very careful with the equipment.
Okay. Tell me about some of the problems or issues that would have come up during any part of the process, as far as weather or any sort of thing like that?
Well, yeah, your weather, of course, is something you have no control over whatsoever, and so you can really get hurt by weather. You can rain at the wrong time, not enough rain at the right time, a hailstorm can totally wipe you out or close to it. So that weather is always hanging there, just, you know, you're always watching the hill, waiting to see what comes over the hill next. We're in a drought cycle now, and that means that you have to irrigate more on the ground that you can irrigate. Your expenses go up. If you happen to hit the other side of the coin and you're into a rainy summer when you can't get the crop to dry out, and then if it doesn't dry out, you can't get it harvested, or at least you can't get it harvested on the time frame that you like to get it done. The grass crop's one that it runs on a pretty tight cycle, and it seems like if you can get everything done about 2 days before you think it should be done, you're in good shape. Mm-hmm. But if you're lagging on the other end and you're a week or two behind, you're not going to raise near the grass that you should. And so that always caused stress within my life, I'm sure. It's just the fact that I like to be ahead of the game a day or two rather than trailing along behind it.
Mm-hmm. Who did you depend on for your weather information? Was this done locally, or did you ever depend on the old Farmer's Almanac? Or
no, I didn't do any of that. In fact, I mean, even locally, you might try to know what the weather was going to be for the next little bit, but in a lot of cases, you just had to take it as it came anyway. The only thing that might have made a difference would have been during harvest. If you thought it was going to rain, you might have worked a little later one night or something like that, or you might have harvested a crop that was more susceptible to rain damage a day or two quicker or something, you know. But most of the time, you just get up and take whatever comes over the hill the next day.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any severe, persistent occasions of bad weather?
We had rain 5 weeks in a row, either Wednesday or Thursday afternoon one summer right during harvest. Every week it rained, and for 5 weeks, not steady, but just a big storm.
We were just talking about persistent, severe weather, and you were saying that it had rained for 5 weeks.
Yep, and so it'd dry out, and normally by about Sunday we'd go again, and Monday it'd be real good, and Tuesday we might get some going, and then who knows, here it'd come again. That was a very frustrating summer, very frustrating for me, and that's when the stress level goes up. I think that was one of the first years that we brought in some propane burners to help burn the grass. Because after the grass seed is harvested, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, we burned all the straw off the grass crop. And then as the anti-burning environmentalists became more vocal, we slowly had to start cutting back and we try now only to burn just what's absolutely necessary. And this has cost us a pretty good percentage of our production. I don't know that anybody can come up with just an exact figure, but the percentage there of seed that is lost because we cannot burn is substantial. It's part of the problem we have now with making a profit on raising the grass.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned some of the environmental issues. Mm-hmm. Were you ever involved in any sort of legislative movements or protests?
When the burning issue first started, it was more so in the Willamette Valley than up here. And at the time that started, I was on the Fine Fescue Commission for the state of Oregon. And I was involved in the Fescue Commission gave money to try and fight that and keep burning as long as they could. But they also gave money to the college and to people that were trying to find an alternative way to raise the grass without burning it, and there was a lot of money spent in that arena. And so it wasn't just fighting trying to keep burning it, it was trying to find another method. And not any of those turned out successful. The cost and the problems there were all such that the propane burning is about the only thing that they could bail everything off, and then propane burn is about the only thing that came out of all that. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of experimenting done, though. I don't think I was on any other environmental, you know, committees or anything, just that one on the Fescue Commission.
Did you find that there was kind of a networking of all of the small farmers in the area as things sort of changed over the years and farming sort of ended up with the bigger, what am I trying to say, more commercialized?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what describe networking. Give me a thought. What you're looking for here?
Just sort of banding together, or looking to each other for help and.
Oh. Well, I think they'll all farmers will probably try to help their neighbor a little bit, but also farmers, you have to understand, are so independent that I mean, they'll band together. Kind of in a Red Cross situation. If a farmer's in trouble, they probably will take their machinery and go down and help him do something. But they're so blooming, you know, they're so independent that they might have the best crop in the world and really making a good thing. And they'll tell their neighbor, well, that's not too good out there this year. Because they just, you know, they always want something that they got tucked away that only they know about. Okay. So I don't know how to answer you other than
sounds to me like there's a little bit of competition then going on.
Very much so. Yeah, always has been. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they always like to have a big crop and a little better than the neighbor. Mm-hmm. Always want to you know, just shine a little bit. They want their place to look a little better than what it does across the road.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about your own personal view of commercializing farms, then.
You mean getting bigger?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's probably what's going to happen. I took over for about three or four people that were living on 160 acres. That had come down through their family, and they'd made a living on 160 acres. And if that lasted until about the 1970s, some of them were gone by the 50s and 60s, but people could not make a living on 160 acres. So the sons and daughters of those people went off somewhere else, and there were several of those people came to me and said, will you farm my ranch? And some of those I did farm, and that's where my rented ground came from. Most of the ground I rented came in 160-acre parcels. Well, now that we're going through another change that's happening now, and the farmers are getting bigger, and they are going from the, oh, I don't know, 1,500 to 2,000 acre farms, and they're just going to get bigger. And the reason for that is because of the cost of equipment, and just the fact that they have to farm more acres to make a profit. And I'm not sure, I don't know if it'll ever end. I'm not sure where it'll end or how it'll end. I'm not able to pencil out a profit on the farm the way I farmed it anymore. I mean, you know, it's just not there. I couldn't do it.
Are you willing to share the amount of acres that you have to?
In what way?
I guess in just how many acres do you have in all total, and then how many of those acres are being utilized?
Well, when I quit farming, we were about 2,000 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And my son took over at about that, and then he grew a little from there. And I don't know where he's, you know, what his thoughts and plans are.
Mm-hmm.
I never owned that many acres. Never wanted to own a lot of ground.
Mm-hmm.
I could only farm so much, and I owned enough to be satisfied with how many I owned. And I couldn't tell you how many I owned. I figured it up every now and then, and forget about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm sure there are hundreds and thousands of untold stories about all the years that you have been farming, but as you sit here and sort of reflect on what we've discussed already, does something else just pop out in your mind that you want to share about the whole industry and about your experience specifically?
Oh, gosh, that's pretty difficult. I think if I had something that I would do differently, it would be I would definitely keep a diary of the things that have happened and the people that have been here, especially when I was first starting, there were a lot of kids that came out and worked for me that I run into 20, 30 years later, and they'll say, "Do you remember when I worked out there?" Well, I don't. I should have written down names and places and dates and events and all of that, because that would be something that would be fun to go back and read now. So I'm sorry that I didn't be a little more careful about recording that. The one event that I think probably is something that you just don't have happen in your lifetime was the time when myself and two of the people working for us, two young men working for us, and my son were over by Somerville, and we saw this bright light streaking across the sky and couldn't figure out what it was. And I said, "Well, it has to be a UFO because it was moving too fast and it was just brighter than bright. Couldn't even look at it. It was so bright you could not describe it." So I said, "UFO, has to be." And I said, "Look back there. You can see where the vapor trail was." Yeah, I said, that's got an engine running in there, and it's a jet engine because it just left that vapor trail clear across the face of Mount Harris. And we could see where it was below the top of Mount Harris and went blazing through. And there were people in the valley that saw it. We talked to other people. Nobody could describe it. But we heard that they thought a meteor had come through. And, of course, we poo-pawed that because we could see where it was lower than the top of Mount Harris by hundreds of feet. And I said, "Well, it couldn't have been a meteor. It would have hit the earth. And because it was so low, no way." Well, about 15 years later, my son came whipping over and said, "Dad, there's a special on PBS about the meteor that came through the valley." And so we turned on PBS that night, and a man had videotaped it. It went from Nevada clear up through Canada, and a man had videotaped it. And it looked and sounded just identical to what we had seen go through. And so that was an occasion that I think was pretty special. They said if it had hit, it would have been like three of the Hiroshima atomic blasts going off if it had hit the earth anywhere. So that's how Mount Harris, if it had been just a little bit east, it would have been like dropping three atomic bombs in the Grand Round Valley. So that's something that not everybody sees.
Do you recall from the special about why it didn't hit? What causes it not to?
There's something about a slingshot type of deal, as close as I could remember. I mean, that it came down, and because of the angle it was coming in, it comes in and it picks up speed as it goes out. And they gave a very detailed description of how this happens. And they convinced me that I had seen a meteor and had not seen a UFO, which I just, boy, there was a long time I told people, oh, you got to believe in UFOs because I saw one. But that wasn't true. It was a meteor.
I want to ask you about another thing. I'm not sure we mentioned it on the beginning of the tape, but you don't go by George.
No, go by G.
How did that come about?
Well, when I was young, of course, Dad's name was George and mine's George Jr., and I had a neighbor lady that was calling me Georgie, little Georgie, and I, for some reason, did not like that. And so my mother said, well, what about Gigi, two G's? And I said, well, maybe. But that's what the folks started calling me. It was two G's, Gigi. And that lasted until I got, until I probably got into the eighth grade or so, and went off to Hill Military Academy for a few months. And I think they probably called me by my given name of George down there. And when I came back and entered high school, you think you need to be a little more grown up. You know, here we are, we're going into freshman in high school. And so I started going by George. And I continued that through high school and some college. And in the military, of course, you had to go by your first name. And then when I came back and I lived with Mom and Dad, the phone would ring and people would want to know if George was there. And Mom would answer and, well, Junior or Senior, you know. Well, pretty soon, the folks were still calling me G. And so pretty soon I just picked up the name G again, and that's what I continued on with. And it, I liked it.